Happy Tuesday, everyone. Welcome to BTR Today's Art Uncovered, courtesy of Shinola here at btrtoday.com. I am your host, Kimberly Ruth. A quick announcement before we get into this week's interview. I'm excited to announce that you can now subscribe to this and any of your other favorite breakthrough shows anywhere you listen to your podcasts. And please, if you like what you hear, read, or watch, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and share, like, and tweet your favorite pieces of content. Happy Tuesday, everyone. Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Art Uncovered. This week, I am honored to be here via Skype with Katie Miller, an American-based artist who is best known for her colorful, hyper-realistic oil paintings of children. She was raised in New Hampshire, Florida, and California, and graduated from the Maryland Institute College of Art in 2007 with a BFA in painting and a minor in art history. She has earned her MFA from the Hofberger School of Painting at the Maryland Institute College of Art in 2011. Katie has had two solo exhibitions in Washington, D.C., and her work has been shown in fairs including Pulse Miami, Volta Basel, The Armory Show, and Emerge. Group exhibitions include the Smithsonian Institute, John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, and Fort Wayne Museum of Art. She is a winner of the Wynn Newhouse Award and an artist grant from the state of Maryland. Her work has been published or reviewed in publications including The Washington Post, Washington City Paper, New American Paintings, and Poets Artists. Katie's works are represented in public and private collections internationally, including the Rubel Family Collection Miami and 21C Museum Hotels. And Katie lives in Maryland, and she works as a full-time artist. All right, everyone, so after this short musical break, we'll return with more about Katie and her work, so please stick around.
So
Hi, Katie. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, Kimberly. Thank you.
There's so many things I want to talk about in relation to your work, and we'll kind of dissect pretty much everything that I had planned over the course of the next 30 minutes or so. But I'd like to start with a series that you have, and it's titled Hyper Real. So I'm just going to quote a statement that you wrote on your website. So you describe it as a series of paintings that, quote unquote, explore the blending of real and fake, the difficulty of distinguishing original from copy, and the melding of natural and artificial. So I'm wondering, Katie, if you could talk a little bit about your interest in this struggle, the struggle of distinguishing real from the artificial. I think especially in, you know, today's age of social media, it's a really interesting topic to explore.
Yeah. My interest in this started a few years ago when my family and my now husband were planning a vacation to a popular theme park resort in Florida. I'm not going to say which one because I have paintings based on elements there. And sometimes these companies can be pretty litigious even when there's no reason to be.
Just
to be on the safe side, I'm just going to say a theme park.
Okay, got it. And we could use our imagination.
Yeah, exactly. At that time, I was trying to figure out what direction I wanted my work to go in. I'd been working for about a decade on various bodies of work that all revolved around children and childhood. And while I was still interested in a lot of that, I also felt like it was just time for a change. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking specifically about the way I paint, which is super realistic, detailed, all in focus. And how often people say that my paintings are more realistic than photos, or they show more details and range of color than one would typically notice in real life, just looking at the world. Mm-hmm. And while part of the reason I paint this way is just because I like to, it's fun, it's representative of the way I see the world, but there's also a conceptual angle to it, and it feeds into the meaning of the work. So with my previous paintings, the technique was alluding both to the history and symbolism of realism and how it reflected changing religious and humanistic ideologies, such as during the Renaissance, as well as our contemporary media with giant billboards and high-def TVs and just, you know, images everywhere. Mm-hmm. But so I started thinking about the concept of depicting reality in a way that looks like, quote, more than real, more than reality, more detailed, more focused, more colorful, more alive, like so real, it's unreal. It goes back again, taking the elements of reality and compressing them and condensing them so much that the depiction of reality feels fake. And it turns out this is really related to the concept called hyperreality, which I can talk a little bit more about that later on. And a really good example of hyperreality are environments like theme parks, where there's like a fake jungle or a fake city or a fake Main Street or whatever. And so I started to think about how my painting style, often called hyperrealism, was in itself a version of hyperreality, and that by depicting hyperreal environments in a hyperrealistic way, there was a lot of interesting material going on there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just started getting really fascinated by that. And like in some of my paintings, it isn't apparent right away what you're looking at. So something may appear to be a cityscape, and only upon closer inspection do you see little details that suggest otherwise. And so while none of the paintings are directly talking about current events, I think that the broader concepts allude to a number of things, like the concepts of fake news, real news being called fake news seeming so much like real, politics, entertainment, meshing together more and more, news photos and videos doctored to suit the aims of those who are releasing them, and even just like regular people like us, like using social media plays into this in a way.
Totally.
You know, we're all living these sorts of like sort of true, sort of fake half realities and personas that we project and inhabit online. So although like each individual painting isn't necessarily about those topics, I think broader, it's just emblematic of like what we're all experiencing in our culture.
Yeah, I have two follow-up questions to that. One, so you started off by speaking about your earlier work, which was depictions of children, and you said that was done in also a hyperreal fashion as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'm wondering like how, because I think you beautifully stated, so your current work, you're focusing on the subject matter of these amusement parks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Among many other subject matter. So I'm wondering how you think like the style of your painting relates to the idea of childhood, because children don't see things in terms of reality, right? They're very egocentric. The whole world is about me.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's really interesting. I wasn't really thinking about, you know, looking at things from a child's point of view necessarily. I was looking a lot at how children have been thought of, like mostly by adults, and depicted throughout time. I'm mostly looking at Western art history because, I mean, that's just what the history of Western painting from, like, you know, medieval, Renaissance, Baroque. That's like my sweet spot. That's the kind of artwork that I love looking at, among many other things. But that's some of my favorite stuff. So I was looking at how children have been thought of throughout time and how they've been depicted, and then looking at contemporary issues like marketing and the sexualization of children through clothes and toys and gender, and how, like, just for example, several centuries ago, children's clothing more reflected their age and not at all their gender, whereas now it's all gender and not so much age, things like that. And how toys are super gender segregated and that sort of thing. So I was looking at a lot of that stuff, and it's kind of hard to describe how it all meshes together in a way. But the realism kind of came into, like, so in the Renaissance, when people started thinking of religious figures as like these icons. I don't know if you can think of like medieval. They're very stylized and
iconic,
they don't really
right?
look like real
look
people.
Like illustrations.
Yeah,
yeah, flat.
Exactly,
and,
they're icons. Mm-hmm. Yes, and they were intended to do that, to be like that. It wasn't because the people didn't know how to draw. It was like that was what they were. And as Renaissance and humanism started exploding, like, people started to think of these religious figures as like human, and so they changed and started looking more real. And so, you know, I was thinking about that, and then how today images are everywhere. We have billboards, we have, the internet, we have high def television, and taking some of that and looking at kids today.
One more question in regards to the pictures of children. Did you ever get feedback mm-hmm. that they look commercial, right? Because I mean, there's this whole trend right now where, and I guess it's not even a trend, it's just kind of what people do at this point, but they have, like, they send photos of their children away to a printer who then prints it on canvas, right? And it's this very kind of kitschy form
of
memorabilia. I'm wondering if anyone has ever made that connection, or if there's some of those kind of critical factors that you mentioned embodied in what you represent.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I haven't actually gotten that feedback, but I was thinking in the Fancy of Babes Imaginary Portraits series, mm-hmm. Which was about like 2012, 2013. And I was actually looking at some like old, like 70s, 80s, 90s, like Olin Mills portraits where like the kids are like in a little portrait studio with like a fake background and you know, the fuzzy sort of hands posed on like a fuzzy, I don't know, I guess it was like
so
a furry
ridiculous.
Thing that covers like a table or something, you know what I'm saying? And I actually, like, in one of them, I used my hands as a 3-year-old from one of those pictures. So I was looking at how, like, you know, but I was also at the same time also looking at, you know, Renaissance pose pictures of like royal children mm-hmm, and then that kind of thing and kind of mushing them together. And then also like disturbing products or products that I kind of find disturbing.
And the title of that project, was that The Fancy of Babes?
Yeah, well, there was The Fancy of Babes, and then there was like sort of a secondary one, which was The Fancy of Babes Imaginary Portraits.
Got it. Yes,
and
so I have those up right now.
And all of the kids in those two series, they're a bit different from a lot of my other work in that none of those children actually exist. And if you look at them carefully, you'll see why and be glad that they don't actually exist. but, you know, because some of the material I was dealing with was what I think of as our culture's very disturbing sexualization of children and in the products that exist and certain things like that. I mean, I wasn't getting into really heavy stuff like child porn or abuse. I was more looking at just like the so-called lighter things that kind of affect the everyday person that are just part of our culture that we might not even notice.
For sure.
So those are the types of things I was looking at, and I didn't find it ethical to use actual pictures of children. So I actually created their faces using morphing software.
Oh, interesting.
So I would like collect like, you know, 5 to 10 pictures. You know, sometimes they were just picture, you know, kids on the internet, or, you know, sometimes they'd be the faces of people I knew who weren't even children. And then I would put them in a morphing software and morph them together and then paint from that. So.
Wow, that's so interesting. It kind of reminds, and to go back to what I suggested before, like kind of my intrigue with your work in looking through the lens of like social media, is that like all of these profiles that we have of ourselves, like we think of them as like self-portraits, you know, and very autobiographical, but no one's profile is accurate to who they actually are. So we are, you know, creating these images of our lives that are like the perfect version of who we are, which
right.
isn't real by any sense of the word.
Right.
Yeah, very cool. And there was another follow-up question, you know, I guess the course of our conversation's kind of branching out quite a bit, but I think that's okay. Can you tell me what led you to this subject matter? And I guess I'm talking more about your current work in which you're depicting the themes of parks and zoos and living history exhibitions, which I find really interesting.
Sure, thanks. Yeah, well, first of all, this series is still very much in progress. I have 3 completed paintings, and I have one, and they're fairly small, and then I have one really big one that I'm hoping to have finished here in a few months, and then I have many others in the pipeline in various stages. Mm-hmm. My paintings take a really long time to make, and if I talk a little bit later on how they're made, I can tell you why. But so, well, like I said before, I started thinking about the concepts while planning a vacation to a theme park resort, and so I started looking at pictures online of places within the theme parks that were meant to look like versions of reality, some of which are versions of reality which never really were, but the details are condensed and simplified, which makes them kind of more emblematic of the thing, like the Wild West or an old-timey Main Street. Mm. You know, the fake version has every element we associate with that thing, even more so than the real thing would have had. Mm. And from there, I began looking at things like fake versions of nature, like zoo exhibits, which are made to look like the natural environment.
Yeah.
You know, how sometimes some of the interior zoo exhibits, like for birds or primates or whatever, they'll have like sponge painted trees on the walls. And like, you know, actually sometimes they're actually really well done little dioramas, you know. It depends. It varies a lot. Or other types of fake nature, like those cell phone towers that are disguised to look like pine trees or palm trees.
Yep, totally. Cacti.
I love the bizarreness of that. Yeah, cacti. I love how strange those are because they almost stand out even more.
They totally
because sometimes they're enormous.
They're
they don't look real at all.
And they're all very phallic looking, which I find really fascinating.
Yes. And some of them are, I mean, I think I've found like and downloaded probably every photo of a fake tree cell phone tower that's on the internet. And I none of them were exactly right for this one painting that I'm planning. And then I ended up just by happenstance seeing one off the side of the highway while I was driving up to New Jersey to deliver a painting to someone. And ended up being able to find it through going through neighborhoods and finally found it and was able to take some good pictures that I was able to use as reference. But so and I also have plans to visit like casinos in Las Vegas and then some of those living history places, you know, like Williamsburg or Plymouth Plantation, those kind of things. So I haven't done that yet, but that's in the plan. And what I do is I shoot references. So before this vacation that sort of started it all, I did a lot of prep work before that vacation. So I figured out what kind of environments that were there that I wanted to shoot. I got an app on my phone that told me like what direction the sun would be from at any given point. Mm-hmm. So that based on where I should visit when, based on the best lighting and the crowd level, et cetera. Mm. I made reservations for a restaurant for the sole purpose of shooting inside it for a painting, which is also currently in progress. It turned into a bit of a working vacation for me, which was a really strange feeling. It was also my first time shooting reference photos on location and in a public place where I didn't have full control over everything. Mm. So that was kind of stressful because typically in the past, I've done my photo shoots. I've done like a mock photo shoot first with a mannequin before I have a kid there in the studio, and it's all controlled and it's all, you know, an environment, and it's just like me and like one other person and some assistants. So this was, it was a new experience, but it was fun. I basically started realizing that I was really interested in this, these simulations, these simulacra, these fake realities, and how they're just everywhere. You know, the concept is everywhere, but actual, like, it just seems like almost every environment that's like meant for recreation, with the possible exclusion of maybe like sports and movie theaters or even movie theaters. I mean, there's an Egyptian themed movie theater where we are, and they have like columns Egyptian inside and like weird lighting. Yeah. I mean, it's just, it seems like everything is
ancient
themed.
Egyptians were really into like IMAX.
Yeah, it was. It's an IMAX, and like the thing looks like some sort of Egyptian temple thing outside, and inside there's like I don't know the names of all the different people, all the different Egyptian gods, but there's, you know, statues of them, and yeah, it's just like, what?
So
but you know, I don't think of any of these things as like a good thing or a bad thing. You know, I'm not saying like this is evil or this is amazing. It's just like, this is a thing that's out there, and it's out there a lot, and it relates to a lot of other stuff. And I find that really fascinating.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense to me why you choose a hyper-realistic style where you're representing it as objectively as you can, as opposed to taking like the creative liberty to accentuate some things to make, you know, your point of view aware.
Right.
I'm wondering, because you mentioned somewhere in your writing this idea of recreational simulacra. Is that kind of what you're talking about? Like these over-the-top kind of kitschy recreations of things that are real in obviously like mass, you know, mass-cultured places?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's actually, it's sort of a term I made up. I mean, the two words together. I mean, simulacrum is, I did not make up. That's a word that, it means like a representation or imitation of a person or thing. The philosopher Jean Baudrillard, who wrote a lot about hyperreality, he says a simulacrum is a copy without an original, like something that becomes its own reality.
Ooh, cool.
And then recreational, because I'm, you know, I'm looking at places that people go for fun, theme parks, museums, zoos, casinos. And our culture is just like loaded with them. It seems like everything is made to look like something else. I mean, even on a very subtle level, even some suburban shopping centers, you know, I kind of live out in a small town suburbs, outside of Baltimore, outside of DC kind of. And, you know, a lot of suburban shopping centers are even made to look like they're trying and actually failing to invoke like old European town squares with their architecture, you know, like, oh, this one's vaguely Bavarian and it has a name like oldie towny centre, you know, if you pronounce it wrong.
Yeah,
but you know what I'm saying with the spelling.
I wonder why these kind of places are so popular. Like, obviously there's like a following and that it attracts customers and consumers, right? Like, I wonder if it's this need for our, like, for nostalgia, or like, what is it that we're so attracted to these places? We mean,
yeah, maybe
it's
Americans. Like trying to inject culture where there isn't much, or I don't know.
Like, what the hell does like ancient Egypt have to do with movie theaters? You know, like, I don't know what the connection could possibly be other than, oh, we need a theme, let's come up with something.
Yeah, or, you know, like, oh, hey, can we go to the movies? Can we go to the Egyptian one? You know, little kids. I don't know. Maybe it makes more money.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm certain it does. And kind of my, I guess, rhetorical question is, I wonder why we're so drawn to places like that. Like, why not, you know, like, living history exhibitions, like you mentioned. Are you talking about places like the Museum of Natural History, where they recreate like African landscapes and
That would be more like a natural history museum. With living history, I'm thinking of like the historic reenactment places, like Civil War reenactment, or like Plymouth Plantation, where there's like pilgrim people dressed in acting as pilgrims, and there's the historic houses. and you actually go and interact with them.
For sure.
Or Colonial Williamsburg, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like exists on a different level. Like, to me, that's for educational purposes as opposed to, you know, something like the movie theater that is just profit based. You know, there's no educational.
Right. Yeah.
Unless they're going to see a documentary. Like, there's no real, like, educational component to it.
Hmm. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I agree. And I think zoos kind of are in between that. You know, they are meant, I mean, today, accredited zoos are meant to be educational, but also entertaining, you know?
Totally.
And so, yeah, there's distinctions and there's a lot of overlap.
Mm-hmm. Like, I'm wondering how many of these places kind of go along with those themes or decors because they're picture worthy, you know, like people could take pictures in front of and selfies in front of the Egyptian movie theater. You know, I mean, we kind of live for the image these days. Unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
So the question I just previously asked was if you could kind of explain recreational simulacra. So I want to continue with that kind of mind frame and ask if you could talk about the difference between hyperrealism and hyperreality. You kind of briefly touched upon it earlier on, but I'd like to kind of, for my own curiosity, you know, kind of what's the difference between those two?
Sure. For starters, I want to say that I'm not an art historian or a philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I don't actually read all that much philosophy because I find most of it confusing and uninteresting, but it's the basic concepts that I explore on my own rather than delving really deep into the text. I do have a passion for art history, and I do read art history, but at any rate, this is just how I understand and I'm working with things. So hyperrealism is a style of art. It's a style of painting or sculpture or drawing. It's often considered like a successor or a cousin of photorealism.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of artists working in a photorealist style today. I really think of photorealism primarily as the movement that began in the late 60s, early 70s.
And that's
as a
painting,
reaction
though.
To,
that's a movement
yeah,
and painting.
Yeah, mostly painting.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So photorealism is painting that looks like as true to the photograph as you can get.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And it was often a reaction to pop art and abstract expressionism.
Mm.
And a lot of those artists were interested in really matter-of-fact reproduction of everyday subject matter. Sometimes there was a conceptual angle, but a lot of times it was just like, this is a depiction of this cityscape or this thing or this person or what have you. And I also think of photorealism as often reproducing the artifacts of photography, like depth of field or lens flare.
Yeah.
It didn't always. I mean, there were people who were doing like, you know, everything in focus too, but and generally hyperrealism isn't making something look like a photograph in that way, like, you know, with the depth of field that a lens would have or the curvature of the lens or that sort of thing. But I mean, they're fluid definitions. You know, there's no real strict categories in art. And then as opposed to hyperrealism being like an artistic style, hyperreality is a philosophical concept. I think Wikipedia actually gives a really good definition, which is that hyperreality is the inability to distinguish reality from a simulation of reality, especially in technologically advanced postmodern societies.
Totally.
Hyperreality is seen as a condition in which what is real and what is fiction are seamlessly blended together so that there is no distinction between where one ends and the other begins. And then there's also a couple other short definitions. So Jean Baudrillard said, a real without origin or reality. Umberto Eco said the authentic fake. And somebody named Peter Sparrow, who I do not know who that is
says
the virtual irreality. I'm really interested in all of those different definitions.
Yeah. I mean, it makes perfect sense to me why you're working with this subject matter and that style. So, Katie, you mentioned that it takes a long time for you to produce your painting. So can you tell me a little bit about your process?
Sure. So I actually do a lot of photography for my work. For the paintings of kids, after I had my concept and had chosen my model, I would use my mannequin named Carol to do a mock photo shoot in my studio to figure out the lighting. I use off-camera flashes, mm-hmm. Which are, you know, triggered by the camera, but you can put them in lots of different places and sometimes use colored gels. So that could get me like the exact lighting that I needed. So I would experiment with that and figure out what lighting setups were most likely to work. And then, when I actually had the child in the studio, or sometimes I went to their house too, it depended on the parents and where they lived and all that. Because none of them are professional models. They're all just like people I knew or like, you know, friends of friends of friends or what have you.
Were they expecting like some fancy portrait of their kids?
No, because they knew. I explained to them that these are not commissioned portraits. They're not, the families aren't asking me to paint their kids. I'm an artist and I'm looking for a model for this concept. And I'd show them my prior work and, I was not paying the models, but I would give the parents and the child prints of the finished paintings.
Nice. Nice.
And that's something that I don't sell. So those are, a unique thing that only they have.
Mm-hmm.
And often the kids would get candy or whatever, too, with the permission of their parents. So, a lot of times there was a lot of creativity involved in getting the child posed. For example, in the life-size figures in my 2014 series, Enduring, there's four by 6 foot paintings, and
wow.
The kids in those are life-size, and they appear to be floating in space. But in reality, like for the photographs, some were standing, some were lying down, and one was jumping on a trampoline.
Mm.
And I had to rig up some interesting apparatuses to get the shots. Like for one, I had to secure my heavy DSLR camera onto a 6 foot piece of aluminum held over a balcony and had the shutter triggered by my laptop. So the lens was directly over the 7-year-old model who was like lying on a coffee table two stories below in a family room. And she was like head to toe covered in beads while an assistant fed her gummy bears. So she didn't move and she did great. She thought the whole thing was really fun.
This painting is so stunning. I'm looking at it right now.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh.
So for each painting, there's a planned photo shoot, sometimes several. I generate hundreds of photos and then I go through them in Lightroom on my computer to start to figure out what I like and what I don't like, which mm-hmm. facial expressions resonate, which direction of the lighting, which foot, which arm, which eye, which ear,
yeah.
Which hair. And then I start collaging in Photoshop.
Wow.
And that process can take several weeks if I'm just doing one full time, but it can take months or even years if I'm just, going at it once in a while with lots of other projects going at the same time. And then for my current Hyperreal series, the process is similar, only I'm working with more of the setting and background than I did previously. So in some ways, these larger ones take even longer to compose. So the painting that I'm working on right now, which you can't see any images of because it's on the website yet, it's got a really complex fake cityscape in the background and then a large head and shoulders figure in the foreground.
Mm.
So it's been like 3 or 4 times the work of anything I've done before.
Mm.
For the smaller pieces that are simpler, there's less collaging, but there's always some editing of the original photo.
Mm.
When the composition is done, I print it out on my large format printer, the same size as the painting will be. So if the painting is 6 feet tall, the print is 6 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
And then I trace it onto tracing paper, like the outline of, just the main shapes. And then I trace the back of the tracing, again, with graphite. And then I transfer it to my panel.
Okay.
I paint on wood or aluminum panels. And I just, I do it by rubbing in the old-fashioned way. And I do that because... For the amount of detail I have, hand looking at something and hand drawing it would take way too long, I find that projection is just not at all accurate. So this is the approach that I prefer. And there's also just there's more of my hand in it too, which I like.
Mm-hmm.
And then I keep the tracing because inevitably as I go, I have to retransfer some lines here and there. And then I cut my reference into at least 2 pieces and I tape it to the wings that are like on either side of my easel. They're sort of these attachments made out of corrugated plastic and door hinges and aluminum that my dad, who is an engineer, engineered for me.
Awesome.
So they go up and down with the easel, and they, you know, I can adjust the angle of them to figure out, like, you know, what the best angle is for looking at my references. Mm. And then I also print out a lot of other reference photos that show other aspects of the subject. So I have, like, my main composition I made, and then I have, like, a ton of others that, like, oh, the lighting in this is more, like, exactly how I like it. Or, you know, here's this detail that wasn't quite in focus in my collage or what have you.
I was going to ask you, because I'm get like kind of zooming in as far as I can to these images before they get too mm-hmm. pixelated, and they are like, I mean, they are hyper real. It is unbelievable. I'm wondering if anyone has ever asked you, like, why not just print the photograph? Like, why do these exist as paintings as opposed to photography?
Yeah, I mean, people who haven't seen the paintings have asked that. When people see the paintings, I think they get it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and even if you see the paintings next to the reference photo, there's so much more that isn't in the photo.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, with oil paint, hold on a second. Maybe just backtrack just a little bit.
For sure.
So basically, the reference photo that I end up with, it looks just like a photograph that someone took. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, maybe a little rougher than that. My Photoshop skills aren't that great, but it isn't. You know, it in itself is a fiction which never existed, consisting of bits and parts from many photos mm-hmm. that I manipulated until it was exactly what I wanted. Mm-hmm. I always hope that one day I'll just, like, capture exactly what I need with the camera, but it never happens. And then I make a painting of the photo composition I made, but the painting always looks better and higher resolution than the photo.
Oh, that's so
and
amazing.
One reason is that the paintings are made of many, many layers. And that's another reason why they take so long. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's not just I transfer the drawing and then I fill it in like, you know, a coloring book with shading or something. I mean, there are upwards of 20 layers in some places. And some layers are opaque and some are translucent and some are transparent and they have different texture. You know, they have the translucency and texture of oil paint adds to the realism.
Absolutely.
And they have more depth than photos. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's why I'm not a photographer. But I do like a lot of photographers. I'm actually interested a little bit in expanding my practice into doing some photography as a finished object. But I, you know, I've only just experimented with it. I haven't done much.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the idea appeals to me because I have so many ideas and so much material. And not all of the material is painting material. Some of the ideas seem like they might be better suited to a photograph rather than a painting, but all of the paintings I make, they're meant to be paintings. Like they wouldn't be good if they existed mm-hmm. as a photograph.
And I feel
like that's not the right medium for them.
Yeah. And I'm thinking too, just conceptually speaking, like to me, it makes so much sense because these scenes that you're depicting, I mean, it's all about mediation of reality, right? And the fact that you're going from a photograph to a sketch to a painting, I mean, it's just layers and layers of mediation, which just for me, I think conceptually speaking, that kind of adds to your ideas of hyperrealism as well.
Yeah, that's the other thing is like I'm making a painting that looks like a photo, which is based on a photo, which isn't a photo, it's a collage.
Exactly.
Which is based on a thing, which is based on another thing that it isn't really. And it gets more layered like that.
Yeah.
It's really fun to paint like this. I mean, sometimes it's very maddening. sometimes it's just like, no, I do not want to paint one more hair or one more brick. But sometimes it's like, it's really cool. And I get to figure out new things. There's always a challenge,
Do you have like a set studio practice? Because obviously you have to be quite dedicated given how long these take. Do you work like only in mornings or certain days of the week?
No, I try to work every day. Mm-hmm. It depends. I mean, depends on what's going on in my life. Like for most of my life, like the past, I'd say 5 to 10 years, I've done like 6 days a week and, you know, 40 to 50 hours a week.
Wow, that's amazing.
'Cause I've been extremely privileged to not have to have an outside job. Mm. And then last year I was not doing nearly as much because I had a lot going on. I was moving and selling a house and buying a house and planning mm-hmm. a wedding and had to travel to like a million other things. Yeah. So last year was this kind of like wonderful, horrible, crazy year that just kind of disrupted things. And now mm-hmm. that I'm settled and, you know, I'm getting into a more steady practice again.
Yeah,
and that feels really good. And I'm also in the process of building myself a studio. So right now I'm painting in a little bedroom. But I've got my permits and we're still in the permitting process. Haven't broken ground yet, but I'm building sort of my dream studio
here on the property that
my husband and I bought.
Awesome. So Katie, do you have any works that are up now that listeners could go to and visit?
I don't right now, no.
Okay, so listeners, you're going to have to check out Katie's website until you show again in person. I would love to see your work in person. Maybe we could do a studio visit or something because these are...
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I feel like these are the types of works that kind of require your physical presence. So please keep me posted. Keep me on your... you know, on your mailing list and all that kind of other necessary stuff for us artists. So your URL is artistkatiemiller.com. And listeners, I will include a direct link to Katie's website and any social media that she allows me to. So if you're listening to this on your desktop computer, click over to the More Info tab. And if you're listening to this via a smartphone, if you just scroll down, there will be links and also some images of Katie's work. All right, Katie, thank you so much for joining me today and kind of sharing your knowledge and practice and work with me. It was an honor.
Thank you, Kimberly. Thank you so much. This was really fun.
All right, everyone. So that's it for this week. To listen to past episodes of Art Uncovered courtesy of Shinola, visit www.btrtoday.com/listen/artuncovered. And if you like what you hear, please rate and review us in the Apple Podcasts. All right, everyone. I will see you same time on Tuesday. Have a safe week. Bye-bye. Birds fly around while the dividends pay. Birds fly around while I'm picking up change. Cropping out tokens and living in a haze. Build lights in the dungeons and plumbing in the graves. Something was a concert, some song was played. But never was delivered and a franchise was made. And what if I told you? What if I said?
change and I'm feeling hazy. Demarcation.